Welcome to the 42nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as England are accused of not taking their preparation seriously for their New Zealand tour, welcome to the podcast that's always well prepared.
So what have we been beavering away on this week? We've been obviously watching England's tribulations down under. Does New Zealand count as down under?
Well, I mean, it's more down under than most of the world. Yeah,
further down under. We've been loving Umar Gul's antics as well. We've been thinking about Bangladesh, and I've been delving into the history of New Zealand cricket. We're also going to be having a look at the much acclaimed book Not Dark Yet by Mike Harfield, and having a debate on the use of recreational drugs in cricket following the Tom Maynard inquiry. So what's been catching your eye?
Well, generally one-off international 2020s don't tend to interest me particularly, but you know the way Cricinfo is, you almost compulsively check every scorecard that's there. So I found myself looking at the South Africa-Pakistan scorecard, and there was just the one figure that struck out, Umar Gul, 5 for 6 off 2.2 overs. And it sort of made me realise that as cricket fans, you know, we love a beautiful performance, we love sort of something, we just love a good stat at the end of the day. And I just thought, what a fantastic stat.
And what makes it even better is we discovered a couple of minutes ago, having never known it before, that it's not the first time.
Yeah, he's done it twice.
He's a serial offender when
he's
it comes to...
He's a serial 5 for 6er. Possibly an unprecedented serial offender.
And also that it's actually not the best figures in a T20. That goes to Adantha Mendes.
Adantha Mendes has twice taken better figures.
Six for eight against Zimbabwe. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and that exactly this thing happened, that you find out a stat like that and immediately go on to cricket, we were looking up the records, and that there's something very compulsive.
Interesting lesson, though, in how stats can sometimes lie, in a sense, in that I promptly looked up the video footage of it, and it's really a very underwhelming 5 for 6. The South Africans mostly cause their own downfall by paying these kind of extraordinary shots where they kind of wander across the wicket desperately trying to flick into leg. So it was quite interesting. I'm sure Gul has bowled far better for far worse figures, but anyway.
And he'll probably be slightly annoyed that he didn't get man of the match for those figures. I mean, you can't really do much more, and the person who did get man of the match didn't even bother to score a century.
That would actually be a fascinating feature that we really should do. Best performances that have not been rewarded with man of the match.
You can do that research.
So away from Umar Gul.
Well, obviously we're in the middle of a New Zealand. We're recording this on Saturday morning. We're in the middle of a New Zealand test, and actually England have, I think, fairly predictably dug themselves out of the hole through a couple of centuries by Nick Compton and Alistair Cook. But I rather liked the fact that the New Zealand's kind of definitions of bits and pieces cricketers came to the party at the beginning of the match. The fact that Neil Wagner, I'm told that it's pronounced Wagner by the Sky commentators.
You want to say Wagner,
but you do want to say Wagner. Who looks like really like he should be kind of lugging hay bales somewhere, and actually that he should be doing it, of course, in South Africa rather than in New Zealand, came rather impressively to the party. And then Hamish Rutherford, who must be one of the most ugly batsmen that have ever graced the Test arena. The fact that he was able to score 171 is something that isn't... It's not unusual in Test cricket, bits and pieces players putting in good performances, but it's certainly very unusual for New Zealanders, where usually you have one or two standout players and then the rest of the team is just kind of completely diabolical almost.
Yeah, in a way it's quite easy to wish well players who are, you know, having their moment, having their sort of day in the sun. Mm. But as you say, England have quite quickly seemed to have put pay to that.
But there's been a lot... going on off the field as well, hasn't
it? Yeah, well, it seems a bit unfair to take a shot at Bangladesh, but I do it regularly, and it's just kind of fun, really. And they've...
It's just too easy, really.
Well, they are... But that's the thing, it's kind of picking on a poor, defenceless beast, but they have introduced this week a new bonus structure, which will involve their Test match players getting bonuses for drawing Test matches. From a totally sort of objective point of view, it's probably quite a sensible idea. Bangladesh lose far too many games. Mm. Drawing a few would actually be a really good development. But I just couldn't help thinking the whole thing reeked of defeatism. I mean, the fact that you're now saying, actually, we can't win, but, you know, at least can we please draw some games. And it sort of brings me back to this whole thing that they've been around for a while. I know they don't get as many tests as they should do. I appreciate that. They're a big country with the Crete Long Island. They keep changing their coaches. I mean, could they just start getting things right? I mean, and I just thought that this was a great, nice sort of straightforward indictment of where they've just gone wrong and they've just become a bastion of mediocrity at the highest level.
It's that classic question of whether the administrators should try and sort of change what happens on the field or whether they should respond to what happens on the field. And I would argue, and I suspect you'd argue as well, that the point of having administrators there and the point of having a management structure is to try and drive some sort of quality to what's happening on the field, rather than saying, okay, you're a bit crap, let's just change the goalposts a little bit.
You're basically saying, let's reward your current mediocrity. Let's find a pay structure
rather than sort of aim towards something.
Away from the depressing tale of Bangladesh, or the depressing saga of Bangladesh.
Into my inbox popped a couple of weeks ago, and an email from my erstwhile colleague sitting next to me here saying I have tickets to day 5 of the of the Ashes at Lords, £574 pop. Do you want them? not really. There's no ticket touting, illegal ticket touting going on here. But yeah, I mean, I have been through the sort of long nights of watching the New Zealand match. I've been getting excited around the Ashes and actually wondering how much the England's trials in New Zealand and Australia getting thrashed in India
twice is
telling us about the test series coming up this summer. I don't think it's going to dampen any of the enthusiasm for us, and actually I think that the Ashes doesn't. I mean, it's never been deciding who's the best team in the world, so the fact that both teams aren't playing as well as they might be, I don't think kind of dampens the enthusiasm for the whole series. But I do wonder what the kind of more the Daily Mail you were telling
me. The Daily Mail headline, can we play the Ashes now? Which particularly after a couple of days into the England New Zealand game felt a little bit.
So they published that after Australia defeat, pre
England's struggles against New Zealand. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, do you think there are reasons to fear that this is not going to be a competitive series? By, you know, the Ashes are not going to be competitive. Should we be afraid of that? Are we going to see cricket on day 5 at Lords? I mean, this is the big question.
I think this Ashes is bound to be competitive because neither team are, however far a performance on getting beaten on the subcontinent doesn't actually, I don't think, tell you much about what's going to happen about a series in England. I don't think that either team are good enough or to put the boot in against the other, and neither team are bad enough to capitulate against the other. And I think it could create some very, very compelling cricket, actually.
Worst comes to the worst, Michael Cook and Alistair Cook, Michael Clark and Alistair Cook, between them will probably make, give or take, 2 billion runs, and that should at least keep us entertained. From the archives, and as England endure a tricky start to their New Zealand tour, Toby is going to give us a whistle-stop trip through the history of New Zealand cricket.
And to start that history, I'm going to go back to 1831, and I'm going to quote from Charles Darwin's The Voyage of the Beagle. Several young men, redeemed by the missionaries from slavery, were employed on the farm. In the evening, I saw a party of them at cricket. And this is Charles Darwin sailing around New Zealand looking for biological specimens and stumbling on what I think is the first mention of cricket there in any sort of written source. And sort of true to form, the mention of the missionaries there, cricket was something that was introduced by missionaries and colonisation to New Zealand, and it was always a pretty, then as now, it's a pretty popular place for teams all over the world to tour. So in the 19th century, James Lillywhite, who now gives his name to the famous sports shop in London, took a team there, various other, George Parr took a team down there. And in 1904, Victor Trumper headed across from Australia and handed out to New Zealand the biggest defeat ever in their history, when they were beaten by an innings and 358 runs, which is fairly substantial. In this regard, it was a bit like Sri Lanka was because Sri Lanka, when it was Ceylon, used to be the stopping off point for a lot of England tourists going down to Australia, vice versa, England going to India and vice versa. And so even though Sri Lanka never got official test status until late on in the 20th century, for 100 years before that they've been playing.
It's interesting actually contrasting that comparison between New Zealand and Sri Lanka with the development of the ICC associates today. Because actually it seems like quite a nice organic way to develop. So, I mean, even if Trump was going there and hammering them by, you know, obscene margins, at least they were getting competitive groups. Whereas you feel now, actually, I wonder if the ICC associates wouldn't... They'd almost benefit from sort of more informal arrangements like that, where teams just go over, have a bit of a warm-up there.
Is it interesting what you say about... countries being able to develop their cricket organically, because the very interesting thing about New Zealand is that they were given, whereas Sri Lanka, they waited for a long time to get test status until the 80s. New Zealand were given test status in 1931 when the MCC toured down under, played four tests. The first one was drawn and New Zealand lost the next three, but they did get their highest ever partnership in test cricket, which was 276 for the first wicket. Stats, we all love stats. But Test cricket was kind of imposed on them in a way. They weren't really ready for it, and also no one else was really ready to play them. So they became they played their first tests in 1931. Then they played South Africa in 1936. I think didn't play any other tests before the war. The war came along, and then in 1945, Australia went over to New Zealand, absolutely annihilated them, bowled them out, I think, for something like 48 and 52 in their two innings. And it was probably, New Zealand were probably rather annoyed about this. It wasn't going to be a test, but after Australia thrashed and the Australians then went to the equivalent of the ICC and said, can we make it into a test match? And they went, yes. So that suddenly this thing was...
I mean, South Africa would probably argue that bowling New Zealand out for 40-odd is actually, you know, not so much a historical feature as a kind of, you know, regular day job.
Exactly.
I wonder, presumably getting test status then was just less of a faff as well. Or was it?
Well, it seems that when world cricket was sort of run much more by a... although, I was about to say, when Test cricket was run much more by a sort of group of gentlemen in a
club
in London. Whereas now it's a group of gentlemen in a club in India. it was much more sort of informal and much more impromptu. And what the result of that was that there was no proper schedule set up that allowed New Zealand to play regular cricket. So, New Zealand didn't play any tests against Australia, apart from that one in 1946, until 1972. Because the New Zealand Cricket Board refused to pay the standard touring fees to the Australian players to come over. And similarly, they never managed to, partly because, you know, if you're going to go to that part of the world, everyone went to Australia and played tests against Australia. There was no regular setup with other countries. And it wasn't until 1955 that they got their first victory in test matches, which is 45 matches in 26 years. After they'd started as a test nation, the fact that they only played 45 matches in those 26 years is telling enough. That's fewer than two tests.
I mean, it's interesting how some of these constants do remain, don't they? Those old moans. I mean, Zimbabwe currently griping about it, totally justifiably, about the fact, you know, how can people criticise them for underperforming when you give them no substantial experience and then expect them to... I mean, New Zealand were facing those exact same battles. Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think, when I was looking back through the history of New Zealand cricket, I was trying to think about what the sort of distinctive elements of the way it's developed have been. One of them is this lack of regularity in playing test cricket. The other one is that when you think of a country like Sri Lanka, which is a comparison we keep on going back to, you can sort of chart the development of their history as a test nation quite clearly. And they sort of got good quite quickly. Then, of course, they won the World Cup in 96. They beat Australia for the first time, I think, in 2000, something like that, 2001. Should have looked that up. Sorry, dear listener. Send us a tweet if we've got it wrong. But the thing about New Zealand cricket, what's distinctive about New Zealand cricket is that you don't get this sense of a narrative of the team from when it started to now. What you do get is you get individual players who have come along and sort of are the defining feature of the team. You think, you know, sort of in chronological order, Richard Hadley, Martin Crowe, Stephen Fleming, Daniel Vittori, Shane Bond through to sort of McCullum now, and you just don't get the sense in the same way. It's very, very difficult to say, oh, the great team of the, you know, mid-1970s or something like that. And I think that's something that's a kind of a big failing of New Zealand cricket.
But it's an interesting point that they've never been able to generate a great side. There's been great individuals, sort of great kind of heroes that you could hang a team around, but there's never been one sort of great side. I mean, I suppose the one thing that's often extraordinary if you think about New Zealand just as a sporting nation, both in sort of rugby and cricket, it is just their ability to kind of punch above their weight. I mean, they are such a small country, but such a sort of small pool. And you think, God, you know, this is a country that they do, even if they don't sort of win always, you know, consistently at that level, that their ability to compete with all these countries that are substantially a lot bigger. I mean, you just think of, for example, a matchup between India and New Zealand, and you get sort of the comparative playing pool you're dealing with. I mean, really, that should be a ridiculous mismatch.
Two things there. Firstly, of registered cricket players within the country. In New Zealand, there are 100,000. In both England and Australia, there are 500,000, which gives something of an indication of exactly that scale that you're talking about. But I think what's interesting about the rugby comparison, and obviously New Zealand massively punched above their weight as a rugby nation, is that the domestic rugby setup in New Zealand is one of the best in the world. And just as a final thought, I found quite an interesting quotation from Mark O'Neill, who is the New Zealand batting coach from 2007 to 2009. He says this: in Sydney, there are 20 first grade teams. Each club has 5 grades. To get to first grade, you've got to be a frigging good player. And once you get there, the competition is very, very fierce. Unfortunately, it's not the same standard in New Zealand. Competition is everything. And the only way the New Zealand guys are going to get that is to play the world's best players. And I think one of the fundamental problems in New Zealand cricket is that they just don't have a thriving domestic competition, as they do in rugby, that then feeds players through into the national team. To the book review, and this episode we are looking at Not Dark Yet by Mike Harfield, published in 2008. And if this book sits within any genre, it sort of sits within the ode to village cricket that we've sort of quite enjoyed in the past. We've looked at Sandy Balfour's What I Love About Cricket and Marcus Berkman's Rayman, both of which have managed to pull off what is quite a tricky feat of writing.
And I guess
about.
Loosely Harry Thompson's Penguin Harry Thompson, Tales,
exactly.
Although that involves a lot of
And intent. The trick of all of these books is to take cricket that happens mostly with slightly overweight middle-aged men somewhere in a village in the middle of deepest, darkest England and make it interesting to a reader. Do you think Mike Harfield succeeds?
I think it's a very difficult book to review because, unlike a lot of the writers we review, Mike Harfield is an amateur, and that we use that word very offensively in like general conversation now. But what I mean by that, Mike Harfield is not a paid professional writer. That's not what he does. And this book is clearly a labour of love. You know, he's clearly decided. He writes about this annual cricket game that he organises every year between the Mike Harfield 11 and the Clifton Hammond 11, and he writes about it. And being totally honest, no, it ranks quite poorly, I think, compared to those other books we've looked at. And I think it shows how difficult it is to make village cricket compelling, because it's something we can all relate to. We've all played it. But to actually make it compelling and find the interesting things in it and pull it out is really, really hard.
In a particularly, to be really analytical about it actually has quite a lot of the ingredients that could work. It has a narrative of a group of people who develop as a cricket team over 20 years playing this annual match. It has little tidbits about other bits of cricket in it. It has general thoughts about life. But to be brutally honest, the sense of narrative is so completely lacking that it was one of the most frustrating and bewildering books, whether on cricket or not, that I've ever read. It's the way that he jumps around from, you know, you get halfway through and over, and then he goes off and talks about the Falklands War for a couple of pages and talks about something else.
I think sort of in defence of that, it's an interesting thing to try to do. To try to meld like reminiscences about your village cricket experience with the wider world, with cricket at the time. Problem is, it's incredibly hard to do. To sort of in one book talk about kind of what were the current events at the time, what was the current cricket, what was my village team doing, to sort of meld it together in a way that's not fit. And I guess it struggles to do that. I think thinking back again to the cricket village cricket books we've read that are successful, personality plays a huge role.
Yeah.
And one thing I think this book struggles with, and in a sense, it's just because of this idea of having it over such a long time. I feel like one of the great things about, for example, Berkman's Rain Man is you really get to know some of the characters, you know, your names sort of become familiar, and you get to embroider it. And I don't think that ever quite happens in Not Dark.
Yeah, you do. I mean, one of the points about Village Cricket is that it's not good cricket. It lives on its sort of the human drama, almost, of it. And that just does not come through at all, I thought, in this. And that when you... when Harfield goes off and comments on other... I mean, some of his analysis of some of the cricket that's sort of happening now, happened in the past, I found pretty lacking, one way or another. And then he sort of just falls back on, mostly on quite a lot of... I mean, I think I counted about 25 times when he makes jokes about Mike Gassing's weight, which kind of just becomes a bit tiresome after a while. And you said something very interesting beforehand, that there are bits of it which you just skip because you just thought, I've kind of seen this, done that.
You
do get the sense that you've kind of, when you read the first five pages, you've read the whole thing, really.
One thing I slightly wonder, though, is audience, because a lot of the cricket books we review in this podcast are tend to be sort of the hard-hitting, kind of almost cricket philosophy books that really try and think about the nature of the game and this kind of thing. And this book doesn't try to do that. You know, this book is supposed to be... it sounds incredibly critical, but it's supposed to be, I think, of the stocking filler genre. You know, it's not supposed to be a heavy read. It's supposed to be a laugh. And I also wonder...
But it's not a laugh. That's the thing. I think that it's trying to be all things to everyone and not succeeding at anything. It tries to have, you know, witty cricket analysis in there, and it tries to have sort of a bit of human drama, a bit of everything else, and it doesn't pull any of them off.
The other thing I slightly wanted, going back to this point about sort of amateurism, which again, I don't use always, and I really am not using it in a negative connotation, I'm purely using it in the sense of this is what the background of the author is, but I think, I wonder whether actually now, when we live in an age where blogging is kind of, I sort of wonder whether aspects of this book wouldn't have made more sense, and actually maybe worked better as part of a blog. You know, if you force into sort of, you know, blogging is often about, you know, some great cricket blogs out there, things like King Cricket, that are built around this idea of, you know, quick, pithy, a funny post. I just don't know if there's really the core material in this to turn it into a book. All that being said, I like the idea of people... I like the idea that cricket literature should be open, in theory. I mean, I like the idea that, in theory... it should be open to... Toby is contorting his face in a variety of ways.
No, I agree. It's one of the wonderful things. Everyone should be able to publish what they say, and the public will, you know, make its verdict by either buying it or not. But I think it's fair to say, just to wrap this all up and disagree with me, if you will, it's fair to say that we would not advise anyone buying this.
I think some people would probably enjoy this book, but I think we were not too... And finally, to the debate. And after the inquest into Tom Maynard's death revealed that the cricketer had been found with large quantities of cocaine and MDMA in his system shortly before his death, we ask whether cricket needs to do more to address the issue of recreational drug use amongst players.
I suppose the main question here is how far a cricket club has jurisdiction over and responsibility for the lives of their cricketers. On the one hand, obviously, a cricketer's health is incredibly important to what their job is. And so if a cricketer is off, you know, whether it be treading on broken glass in a party or taking recreational drugs, then that is going to impact on their life within the club. But then the other question is that ultimately, in all jobs and with all companies, as it were, once you walk out of the door, that's your own time and it's not the company's time.
Mm. I mean, interestingly, of all the debates we've had, this is really a kind of political debate, isn't it? This is much more about bigger ideas than just cricket itself. It's inevitable, I think, after Tom Maynard's death, which it was a tragedy that really, I think it affected people with any connection to the game, or even beyond it. You know, to see someone so talented cut down in the prime is very difficult for society to deal with as a whole. But the problem is, that difference from mourning to knee-jerk reaction is always very unhelpful, I think. And instantly people have come out and said, we need more regulation, we need strict things. I very strongly go on the side of libertarianism here. I really feel that we need to see that it's ultimately the responsibility of the cricketers. It really is the responsibility of them, the individuals, to govern their private time in a way that's sensible. You're very right that the clubs have a stake in how they do that. But the idea that they necessarily need to be constantly kind of keeping tabs is a little bit...
Well, I think that's the question. Where should clubs be punitive or should they be supportive? Because one of the big questions that came out was whether players should be regularly tested for recreational drugs. And there's a big difference between that and cricket clubs providing adequate... I think a question which is kind of underlies all of this, which is cricket clubs providing adequate sort of psychological almost support for their players. Because, interestingly, obviously no one will ever quite know what happened on the night that Tom Maynard died, but he was quite clearly pretty upset about life, and certainly the reports were saying, you know, he's talking to his girlfriend, and how much it was brought about by the fact that he was completely plastered is another question. But people don't generally use recreational drugs sort of heavily and irresponsibly if they are completely sort of mentally supported in that sense. And so there is that question about whether clubs should be kind of coming down like a ton of bricks on people who are using it, or saying, actually, if there's a problem with drugs in our sport, maybe there's something we can do about it, and there's something about the condition of being a club cricketer, the fact that, you know, you spend a lot of time with huge adulation from the public with great success, and then you spend a lot of time with huge lows as
well. I think what was actually came as a real surprise to me is that these young cricketers were very much living the kind of lifestyle that we see more with actually the young footballers. Yeah. I mean, it's tragic in the context of what happened, but the inquest provided a very detailed account of the night out. And it was Rory Hamilton-Brown, Jay Dernbach and Tom Maynard out together. And they were, you know, they were living the life, you know, they were hitting things very, very hard. And it's interesting the extent to which you need a kind of paternal relationship from the club. There's an interesting football analogy here, and that Alex Ferguson's often seen it his responsibility at Manchester United to get the young players settled down. Apparently, according to all accounts, he loves to get them married very early. And it's always been quite interesting, because Man U, obviously, incredibly successful club things. And it's interesting to what extent it's obviously in the club's interests to exert that sort of control. But it then comes down to the question of whether do they have any right to do so. And I think that's where the sort of difficult boundary comes in. I mean, in Surrey's interest, they don't want their players going out on a night like that. On the flip side, Maynard, Hamilton-Brown, Dernbach are young guys, prime of their life, money to spend. They're going to want to go on a night like that. And that's a very difficult balance. And I suppose the trust between the club and then the interests of the club, balancing those is very hard.
It's interesting what you're saying earlier about a knee-jerk reaction, because if... This might sound slightly trite, but if Tom Maynard had, if he hadn't died, if the police hadn't seen him and he hadn't been stopped and he got to his girlfriend's flat or, you know, fallen asleep on the side of the road or whatever it is, we wouldn't be having this debate. Similarly, if Andrew Flintoff on the pedalo had overturned it and had drowned in the sea, when that happened, that was all about personal responsibility. Everyone said, it's Andrew Flintoff who is doing this. He is the person who's gone out, got drunk, let down his team, etc., etc. There was no one, as far as I can recall, who was saying, actually, the England management should have had more of a handle on him and that it was the fault of the England management. With Tom Maynard, who has died, it's not... No one has really been saying, Tom Maynard, isn't he a complete... I mean, frankly, actually, the friends who you're with should never have let him anywhere... should have done everything to not let him anywhere near a car.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting that we've immediately flipped the responsibility back to the club, whereas elsewhere we've been very happy for it to be personal culpability.
And I think, I wonder if... I mean, the issue of sportsmen going off and having a good time to come out, you know, I think the general consensus, I've always really understood, that there's a kind of unwritten pact, really, that... You do it as long as it doesn't affect your performance on the field. I think actually that's generally what the clubs have been happy with. And that seems to be a nice balance between you fulfil your obligations as a cricketer and you get to sort of, you get to have a life, sort of have a, you know, have that sort of life on the sides. But I wonder if what's really complicated this is the issue of drugs as opposed to alcohol. Because I think as a society, I mean, the Flintoff comparison is a really interesting one, because I feel like a society, we shrug off and have a laugh about drunken escapades. I actually don't think we take the issue of, for example, Andrew Flintoff apparently being consistent. You know, I don't want to use these words too frivolously, but very consistently drunk while captain of England down under in Australia. We all treat that a bit frivolously, actually. We don't think it's a big deal. The moment drugs are involved, I think our reaction societally is to say, wow, that's a lot more serious. And it's interesting. I mean, whether that's a fair thing, that we suddenly escalate our concerns when drugs are mentioned ahead of alcohol, is interesting.
Thanks for listening to the 42nd episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. We'll be back in another couple of weeks, but until then, we're always keen to hear what you've enjoyed, what you haven't enjoyed, and any of your thoughts on any of the topics that we've discussed. You can join us over on Twitter, @ReverseSwept, and we look forward to seeing you there.